one swift motion, he drew it and held it up, shining in the torchlight. "It is my sword Rindon," he said. "With it I killed the wolf." There was a new tone in his voice, and the others all felt that he was really Peter the High King again.
So, Glumfiddle, how soon after reading Lion, the Witch, of the Wardrobe did you read Prince Caspian? Because I actually don't know.
I read the first half of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then on one night, it was very late at night when I started these, and then I got up the next morning and quickly finished Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and I think started reading Prince Caspian that night. Because I started reading Wardrobe not intending to go through the whole series or anything. I just sort of said, oh, what's this? And started reading, and next thing you know, it's my life. I definitely knew there were other books, and I went right into Prince Caspian right afterwards.
Yeah, I was maybe six or seven when my dad read all of them to me. I don't know what the span was. Took up a good portion of my life, because he'd read maybe a chapter a night. I guess it wouldn't be that long. But we just went from book to book.
Yeah, I think that Wardrobe and Caspian, if I had to pick two books in the series that seem very kind of closely connected, I would pick Wardrobe and Caspian as almost mirroring each other. In terms of, obviously, they have the same characters, and it follows a similar structure of, you know, the four children entering Narnia, and then
it's like Rocky 1 and 2. Similar structure, a lot of the same characters.
You don't need one. You can read just Wardrobe, or you can read Prince Caspian, but Prince Caspian especially just works a lot better if you've already read Wardrobe, because you'll really feel what the kids are feeling. The full title of Prince Caspian is actually Prince Caspian, The Return to Narnia, because that's what the story is about. The kids coming back, and it's not the Narnia they expected. It's not something not the Narnia they remember. And
here's an interesting thought. Run with me on this. Do you think, let's say you just read Prince Caspian, do you think you would actually gain a more complete picture of the characters and of Narnia than if you just read Wardrobe? As I'm thinking about it here, you think about Prince Caspian, the way that he fleshes out the four children especially, there's a lot more compacted in there in terms of their decisions and their character that's revealed through different decisions. A little more round, just in terms of the character development.
Maybe. I think all that stuff you're talking about is, you appreciate it, it has more impact, it's deeper, if you've already read, you have the background of Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And certainly the themes in the story about, you know, the return to the old days after all this corruption is much more powerful if you got to experience those old days to a large extent in the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I find a big part of the emotional impact of Caspian comes from the kids coming back and going, well, this isn't what I remembered. You know, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, it was very, very different. But it's funny how Lewis links them together. He opens it up the same way he does Wardrobe. You know, once there were four children, and it's been told in another book called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, how they had a remarkable adventure. And then he kind of clues you in case you haven't read Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
It is sort of interesting just how they are, you know, pulled into Narnia. And, of course, I like it because it is someone who is, you know, being summoned, not someone who's summoning someone else or trying to work the magic. They're the ones on the receiving end of the magic.
Right, a bit like living at the mercy of the telephone, Father says.
Yeah.
Now, when they first get there, did you immediately go, oh, they're in Narnia? Or did, because the kids, although Lucy says, do you think we could have gotten back to Narnia, Lewis plays it up as this mystery. So did you immediately know, oh, of course they're in Narnia?
Oh, yeah. I mean, who am I kidding? I knew. I did kind of wonder where, because I think you start to catch on by the end of the first book that, okay, there is actually, I mean, there's a world with a country called Narnia.
Uh-huh.
The whole universe isn't called Narnia. So
right.
I did kind of wonder what was going on. I think it did take me a while to really realize, I think I did just assume, oh, they're, you know, maybe it's been a year.
Right.
The thought of it being over 1,000 years never occurred to me.
Right. So I guess the more important question, I guess I'd say about the same as you, but the more important question is how soon did you figure out that it was Cair Paravel? Because that's, once again, that's one of the big mysteries that Lewis is playing up, what is this place and what does it all mean?
I think I figured it out about when the children did. I don't think I'm trying to remember. You know, you're asking me to remember back years ago, over 10 years ago. I don't think I really figured it out any earlier than they did.
I just seem to remember reading it thinking, well, gosh, maybe it's Cair Paravel in ruins. Oh, but the kids don't seem to realize it? Okay, in that case, maybe it's not. I guess I was right. But it's definitely one of the big mysteries Lewis plays up, and the fact that they don't recognize it. You know, they come back to Narnia, and their initial reaction is the excitement of, oh, we could be back in Narnia, and then, wait a minute, where are we? And they don't even recognize it because it's so different. And the tragedy, what's been lost, I think is going to be explored here.
I think what helps heighten the mystery is they get comfortable there. I mean, they're eating apples and they're camping out there. And they sort of get a certain level of comfort there, assuming it's someplace other than Cair Paravel.
Yeah.
So I think the audience sort of assumes the same thing. And so it doesn't – and again, you only had a couple different time games. It was sort of like, oh, okay. So you might come into Narnia and it might be a week or it might be a day, and no time ever passes while you're in Narnia. But you don't – I don't think I ever thought, whoa. You mean it's that crazy? As in it might be 10 minutes, it might be 1,000 years just at any random entrance. You know,
right.
That's
what – Well, you could really break that up and ask yourself, why is it that Caspian – blows the horn, and it calls them...
A year later?
Yeah, a year later. Could it have been 10 years later, or 10 seconds later, or is there any particular reason it was at that moment? I mean, you could really think this through
yeah.
and drive yourself crazy, but...
I'm not going to be able to sleep tonight, thank you very much.
But I think that really brings us to one of the great scenes in the series, which is the discovery of the treasure chamber. And again, this is the confirmation that this is Cair Paravel, and sums up Prince Caspian, just the mood of it and a lot of the important themes of it very in this one scene, which is that feeling of return, that it's so good to be back, and yet something is lost and has to be restored. And I obviously love the moment where Peter takes out his sword and says, "It is my sword, Rindon. With it I killed the wolf." And I love the Pauline Baynes illustration as well. That's definitely one of the great scenes in the series.
Yeah, I'm looking at that right now, and it's sort of interesting. You know, Lewis still kind of fills in. I mean, I know a friend who did read Prince Caspian first without reading any of the others first, and this friend was able. You know, it worked enough that they were willing to read the rest of the series. But you have little things like, you know, "We must take the gifts," said Peter, "for long ago, out of Christmas in Narnia, he and Susan and Lucy had been given certain presents which they valued more than their whole kingdom. Edmund had no gift because he was not with them at the time. This was his own fault, and you can read about it in the other book." You know, just things like that, you know. So it's sort of a, okay, moving on. You know, if you hadn't read it, you know, you'd just sort of, oh, okay, minor point.
I really like the end of chapter two. You're really on this emotional high of, oh, the kings and queens of Narnia have returned. And then you turn the page, and the attitude is, we simply got to get off this island. And it's so kind of human and real.
That's what I love is, you know, the worst of sleeping out of doors is that you wake up so dreadfully early. And that, trust me, that's true. One of the things that I look for in any book or film or anything, a piece of fiction I look at, I want it to feel real to me. But then there's some things that can feel real and then others not. You know, for some people, they read a book with a unicorn in it and they think, oh, that's not real. So maybe they can't enjoy it. For me, I don't care what the situation is. I want the characters, the people, to behave in a way that is real and believable. And I want them to wake up groggy with sleep in their eyes, and I want them to get hungry, and I want them to get really uncomfortable wearing the same clothes every single day.
But we can have both, you know? Like, at the end of this chapter, it's all really epic and fairy tale.
Oh, yeah.
And that's great.
Oh, yeah,
and yet,
absolutely.
At the same time, these epic fairy tale characters still hate sleeping out of doors because you wake up so dreadfully early and uncomfortable. And I love the practical reality of that.
Let me ask you, what was your thought when you encountered Trumpkin? Because, you know, you encounter him with no backstory. You just know these guys are trying to drown him.
I think it happens at just the right point in the story where, okay, this is starting to drag a little bit. They've just kind of been wandering around, making little discoveries.
Eating apples.
Right.
By campfires.
Lewis even writes here, when they see the boat, for now something was happening, as if nothing's really happened before this. And so I think the arrival of the strange dwarf, whose name, conveniently enough, we don't know is Trumpkin for quite a while. He doesn't tell them his name. And we don't find out his name is Trumpkin until after he's told his story. Little convenient, but then again, I guess I never noticed it.
I don't know if I thought of that either.
But my first impression of him, it probably comes from that line they say, you know, what were they trying to kill you for? And Trumpkin says, he says, oh, I'm a dangerous criminal. First time I read it, I take that seriously. I go, he's probably boasting a little bit. Oh, yeah, I'm a dangerous criminal. I've killed 3 people. You know, he's trying to intimidate them a little bit. And that kind of affects my perception of him. And then I read the story, not knowing Trumpkin is the storyteller. By the end of the story, I have a totally different perspective of who this guy is. And now I read that and go, oh, yes, that's Trumpkin's sarcasm that we've kind of seen. So who Trumpkin ends up being is totally different to who you think he is initially.
I guess I sort of assumed, oh, finally, something make-believe, a dwarf, finally. But then at the same time, you're sort of, oh yeah, well these are the people here, so they can be good or bad. You don't know. And I think one of the first thing that really kind of surprised me in Prince Caspian was just the fact that, I mean, we pretty quickly got into, you know, his story of Caspian, and I thought, oh, this is, we're gonna have a huge part of this. I almost had to settle back in my chair and let this thing there. Oh, we're going to be here for a while.
Right, and it takes you a while to kind of accept that. And I think this is the weakest part of Prince Caspian. That initial transition, the first time you read it, is really hard. Like, I was just starting to really get interested in who is this dwarf guy, and how does it connect to the Pevensies being a Caer Pervel? And now I kind of have to start over. It's like a little book within this book.
Yeah, but it is difficult, and it's one of those things where it works better for a book than it does for, you know, pretty much for anything else. I mean, you can't do certain things.
Yeah, here's why they couldn't just do the book exactly when it came to film. It's not even a structural thing. It's just, listen to the way Lewis describes this. At the end of chapter 3, he says, you know, so the dwarf settled down and told his tale. I shall not give it to you in his words, putting in all the children's questions and interruptions, because it would take too long and be confusing, and even so, it would leave out some points that the children only heard later. But the gist of the story, as they knew it in the end, was as follows. Now, that's where the focus on the family radio dramas got it wrong, because they had Trumpkin take over as the narrator of the story. But that's not what Lewis is doing here. He's saying, I'm going to tell you this part of the story, and then we'll rejoin the kids later. What's the film equivalent of that?
If you were, it would give you the impression that you get back to the children, and then you get the idea, you look at your watch, hour and 10 minutes has gone by in the film, nothing's happened, which you don't want. So is it a mistake? I don't know, it's kind of hard to call it a mistake for the book. Could have possibly been pulled off better. When you think of the story, it works better on a page-by-page basis than it does on kind of a macro level, looking down at the story.
I mean, here's the way I would say it. I almost think the fact that it's a flaw initially almost makes it work better ultimately, because it makes that aha moment 4 chapters later that much more powerful.
It does, and if it works, one thing it also does is you come into Narnia with all these questions of what is going on, where are we exactly, is this Narnia? Then you find out it is Narnia. What on earth has happened? And it fills that in. So you get the benefit of being able to have the mystery. If you were to just start off with the, you know, chronologically, with Prince Caspian growing up and then fleeing, you wouldn't have any mystery of, oh, what's going on? And so it allows you, I think the main thing that this structure does is it allows you to experience the story and the revelations the way the 4 children did.
A very interesting connection is established between Caspian and the Pevensies pretty quick, which is that Caspian has heard stories of the Pevensies, and they're sort of bedtime story characters for him, which for me is one of the most, probably the most interesting idea in the book, that characters that I know well from Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and earlier in this book, Caspian's talking about them like they're these ancient legends.
Lewis, I think he's pointing out that there are things that, yes, you can know something well, but that doesn't mean that there's not going to be this, it's not going to become a legend later on. And it's just a dynamic I think he's bringing in here, kind of saying, what if this was someone you knew?
Right, he gives us the other side of it.
Yeah, the other side of it, exactly.
Which you get to an extent in Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe with Lucy, you know, with Tumnus looking at Lucy like she's this strange creature.
Yeah.
When it really should be the other way around. But Prince Caspian, I think, is that I feel like he made a whole book out of that idea. Of the strange creature being the one that's fascinated by you.
Well, because even then, you know, he talks about, like, what if Arthur came back? Even then, if someone were to write a book about that, it would not be from King Arthur's perspective. It'd be from everyone else's perspective. I think one of the things that stuck out, I do remember sticking out to me, is, okay, yeah, everyone likes Caspian. He's a very likable character. But I really loved Cornelius. You know, he's brilliant, but he's also very mysterious at the same time.
Very mysterious. You know, I think that if I was ever going to have Lewis write a little mini prequel story, little prequel origin story about a character, Cornelius would be one of the characters I would consider. Because
he says, how did you get the horn? And he says, you know, many dangerous journeys that I went on.
I wonder if just one of those journeys might make for an interesting book.
Yeah, and I'm thinking, okay, so he went on these journeys.
Did he always know he was half dwarf? What was his reaction?
And he says,
when
I have a little
out?
Magic that I can use. You know, I'm thinking, whoa. There's all these things.
I know.
You're thinking, wait a second. You know,
a lot
what
of untold
did.
backstory here I would love to know. And I love, and a lot of that Cornelius's backstory, little we know of it, comes out in, again, one of the most famous and iconic scenes in the series that tragically wasn't in the movie, unless you've played the video game, in which case you get a very kind of a sort of a version of it. But it's Cornelius and Caspian on the tower, looking at Tarva and Allenbell, and that's where you really get a sense of Caspian's awe for the old days. And once again, he's looking at him like, wouldn't it be cool if the Avengers were real, almost kind of thing.
It's such a memorable scene, and it's where, you know, the truth comes out, and he's actually...
And this, the setting of being under the stars, and this is secretive, don't tell anybody. It just has this really great kind of sacred... epic feel to it.
But it's still
really
distant. It's still distant because, okay, yes, he's half dwarf, but only half dwarf. You don't really get the, oh my goodness, I'm not just believing it's real, I actually know it's real. And you know, until, you know, Caspian actually goes to the den and meets Trumpkin and the others.
You certainly get a part of it, though. It's your first real physical glimpse that Caspian can touch.
It's like Lewis is still holding out on the dessert. You know, it's like, okay,
but I love
yes.
That it's not all. Wow, this is amazing, you know, a dwarf or half-dwarf or whatever. I love, this is probably one of the most interesting character moments in this in the book. Lewis writes, two thoughts came into his head at the same moment. One was a thought of terror. He's not a real man, not a man at all. He's a dwarf, and he's brought me up here to kill me. The other was of sheer delight. There are real dwarfs still, and I've seen one at last.
Yeah, and there's all these little hints. Like, I love how there's little mentions of just, you know, what Caspian is doing, what occupies his days. He says, this is... Chapter 5, where it says, you know, his education was beginning in earnest. He learned sword fighting and riding, swimming and diving, how to shoot with the bow and play on the recorder and theorbo, whatever that is, how to hunt the stag and cut him up when he was dead. And I think this is something that I kind of wish, I wish the movie would have been able to play up, but, you know, you get an idea that really time has been going past. That, like, this meeting on the top happened maybe at a younger age, maybe a couple of years have gone by, and you have, you know, Caspian finally, you know, kind of wisening up and becoming less naive and realizing, oh, okay. And I kind of have, I don't know, when I read lines like, and he also began to see that Narnia was an unhappy country, the taxes were high and the laws were stern and Miraz was a cruel man, I have little pictures in my mind, like, of him riding on his horse through a village and seeing the people. You know, I just have little pictures of that.
You come out the other side of this. I think for Lewis spending, you know, just a few pages, well, we'll get more than a few pages on this, I think you do get a lot out of it. You do get, like you said, it's the feeling that time has passed, Caspian's grown up a lot. But, you know, most importantly, as all this is going on, I think this is probably the most important kind of single statement that kind of defines the character. It's at the beginning of chapter 5. It's one of the first lines. And Lewis writes that thinking and dreaming about the old days and longing that they might come back fill nearly all his spare hours. And that's not just... the character of Caspian, that's the book to me right there. You know, the longing for the old days to come back. You know, things used to be right, and now they're very, very wrong, and they have to be restored. But so similar to how, you know, when the kids got to Narnia, they had just sort of sitting around, heard a lot of nothing, a lot of introduction going on. That's kind of what we have here. And then finally in the next chapter, something happens, which is sort of the real plot of this, that Caspian is the true heir to the throne, and Miraz now has a son. And that kickstarts very, very quickly. And once again, a very intriguing connection to the Pevensies, that Cornelius has Susan's horn, which we forgot to mention in the treasure chamber. That's the one gift that's missing. Oh, I'm sorry, that's not the one gift that's missing. Lewis seems to forget about Lucy's dagger. I don't know if it was an intentional decision to take out Lucy's dagger.
That's true. I'd noticed that in the past, but I'd forgotten about it.
But not that it would matter. Much more important that Susan's horn is missing, because we're not really sure exactly how the Caspian story is connected with the four children yet. And now we have our first kind of concrete idea that, okay, Susan's horn is missing, and Dr. Cornelius has it. You know, how did that happen, and how does all this connect back together?
This is where the story really gets good. Something is at stake. You know, something bad's going to happen if you know, we don't do this. And that was, I think, where I first really kind of, you know, sat up in bed when I was listening to my dad's tell the story. And he really wanted to pay attention, because this was the moment where, you know, he's running off in the night and you realize, oh my goodness, they might, you know, kill the title character. That can't happen! You know? I mean, it's like, oh no! But
yeah, this is where the plot really gets going. I love the image of Caspian... fleeing on his horse Destrier, and the fireworks in the background.
I have to say, this scene, when he hits his head and he wakes up in the den, This is one of my favorite dialogue scenes in the whole book. I don't know. It's just such an interesting introduction to each character. I just love Caspian's attitude through all this. I think it says just the way he approaches everything, the way he's so honest with them, and at the same time so curious. You know, it just says a lot about him. And this was actually the scene that I sent him when I sent in my audition tape to Pippa Hall and Andrew Adamson for Prince Caspian, because it's just a really neat moment. I love, you know, his perspective on them and their perspective on him.
Well, you very quickly get a sense of who these three characters are. You have Truffle Hunter, who believes the old stories completely through and through. You have Trumpkin, who's the opposite end of it. He doesn't believe them at all, thinks they're both ridiculous. Nickabrick, kind of sort of undecided, doesn't know what to think. You know, later he'll say, I'll believe in anyone or anything.
He's self-serving.
Riddus of these Telmarines.
He's self-serving. Yeah, you know, Trumpkin's more
practical.
He's more of a, you know, sort of a like a realist, sort of a secular realist. Like, you know, if I can see it, it's real. You know,
right.
But I'm not going to believe if I can't see it. You know,
Nickabrick's interesting because I always feel that again, Nickabrick probably has a compelling backstory as far as he just seems. I always felt he seemed very hurt. Something maybe the Telmarines have cost him something very specific. Maybe they did something to... I don't know, I always get the feeling that he was sort of a wounded child, in a way, on the way he behaves. And it's funny, if I had to guess, I don't remember trying to figure out, oh, one of these characters must be the storyteller. At this point, I've almost forgot about the storyteller. But I probably would sooner have guessed Nickabrick than Trumpkin, just because of that line, oh, I'm a dangerous criminal, I am. And I think, oh, this seems more like a Nickabrick kind of character, that he would sort of boast about that. I almost wonder if Lewis did that intentionally to sort of put you off the scent. If you were trying to figure it out, you wouldn't guess Trumpkin.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's and even, you know, just the way that everyone responds, like when he says, you know, the king wants to kill me. If you killed me, you'd have done the very thing to please him. You know, you almost have, Trumpkin, eh? What? Say, Trumpkin, what's that? What have you been doing, human, to fall foul of Miraz at your age? You know, you have, these are just their attitudes and their responses to the situation. You just make it, I think, just sets up their characters pretty well. And
again, I think this is yet another example of this sort of summarizes, this captures the essence of the book, you know, or at least the essence of the Caspian character, his awe and his excitement that all these fairy tale characters are real and they're in front of me and they're talking. And this is like a talking badger. He's obviously heard about talking beasts, but he still wasn't, even Dr. Cornelius doubted if talking beasts were still around or if the Narnians were still around.
Yeah. And again, this is the first scene where it's like it all comes back. And I feel kind of like, I don't know, what reading this scene reminds me, it, I don't know if it even reminds me, but it feels like Lucy and Tumnus's cave. It has that same kind of, you know, even just discussions of what's real and what's not real.
And I think that's for Caspian, the next... at the beginning of chapter 6, now began the happiest time that Caspian had ever known. It's probably one of the most surreal times, too. You know, just a few days before, Dr. Cornelius was telling him these stories, and now here he is, and they're real, and they're in front of me. They're not just legends anymore. And there's a lot of memorable introductions here. Obviously, the Bulgy Bear is sort of a, in terms of minor kind of throwaway characters, Bulgy Bear is a favorite. And then another character who seems like sort of a throwaway character initially, but will grow into arguably the most beloved characters in the series.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of characters we could, you know, there's a lot of introductions and characters that Caspian meets that we could talk about, but we just have to talk about Reepicheep, even though it's a little scene, just because he's going to become such a fan favorite eventually.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that he does kind of stand out. A little section where he speaks to Caspian, you know, he is polite, courteous. Caspian tries hard not to laugh, and then it just sort of moves on, you know, to the next group of animals. One thing I loved about Prince Caspian that's emphasized here is I love how the centaurs read the stars, because it's easy to come up with a world, like a fantasy world, where it's like there's substitutes. Okay, you don't just have talking people, you have talking animals. You don't just have, you know, countries, you have kingdoms. It's like there's everything can be substituted for everything else, you know. But I just love that, you know, how the world works. It's like the mechanics of how the world works itself.
You're talking about Tarva and Elendil and all that stuff. It means some great good for the sad realm of Narnia.
Yeah. You know, he never explains, well, how do the stars exactly line up? If, you know, how do they know when this is going to happen? So I don't know, little things like that. I just love that not only is it's a difference in how that world works and how this world works, just, you know, and how the stars function, But it's also different from how people in this world like to think that stars work sometimes. You know, it's like a whole different twist. And I know that, you know, part of it's explained in the last battle. And, well, no, Aslan doesn't. He doesn't come because the stars tell him to. You know, they line up because of what he's...
And, of course, we'll actually get to meet a couple stars in Dawn Treader in the next book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so there's all these different things that I think I just love where it's just, you know, time works differently. It's like the whole physics, the whole fabric of that universe is just different. It's not like you just made a copy of our world and changed it. If this was a universe that really did start from scratch with a different kind of beginning.
I love how when he goes to meet Glenstorm, and apparently that's the first moment where Caspian sort of goes, oh, you mean like a war? Like, actually fight. Like, before this,
Caspian, I guess, war?
some of that naivety is still there with Caspian, maybe. I think he just gets caught up in the fairy tale of, yes, I'll be the king of the old Narnians, and I'll walk around with my sword, and, oh, you mean actually fight? And so this is what's going to kind of launch the story into its next act, is, yes, a war to drive out Miraz. That's what
he says, do you mean a real war to drive out Miraz?
Turned out like a pretend war.
Yeah.
Caspian is about to make his really dramatic speech when we have the arrival of Dr. Cornelius back into the story. And you just have to wonder, hasn't Dr. Cornelius been trying to find the Narnians for a very long time? And now he's just finding them now, like, with no trouble at all? I guess maybe he didn't really find them. I guess they go out and they get Dr. Cornelius and bring him in there. But he says, you know, I had a pretty good idea of where to find you. And maybe you could argue that it's something to do with Caspian. But I guess I wish they made it a little more difficult for Cornelius to find them, since it's such an important point that the Narnians are very difficult to find. They've obviously lived in hiding for very long, even though Cornelius was actively searching for them.
I don't know. Maybe you could say, well, he knew what the Dancing Lawn was, but they hadn't had a council there in a long time.
I don't know.
But I do agree that it is a little odd. Do you get... Okay, this is something that kind of frustrated me when I read the book. Do you get the idea that this is a really, really small army that Caspian has?
Now that you mention it, maybe I do a little bit. Mostly because of just how innocent they all seem. I don't seem all that intimidated by them. But now that you mention it, yeah, I guess I kind of do think of it as a small army.
I don't know, just little things. Like, even as it's doing the run back down on the, you know, the five black dwarves and, you know, the 12 mice and the three bulgy bears and the centaurs and, you know, his son, you know, Glenstorm and his sons. How many sons could he have had?
Right.
You
know?
So I think sometimes I sort of cheat in my mind and I was like, well, just so that the picture in my mind is a lot bigger.
Right.
I'm going to imagine a lot more.
That's fair enough, I guess. So Caspian never quite gets to do his epic speech. And they decided to go to Aslan Tau, which, and again, we don't know that initially. Aslan Tau, what is that? Oh, it's the stone table. And that's once again of, you see something that seems new, and then you find out, oh no, this is familiar. We've been here before.
And it kind of makes sense, because why wouldn't they have a different name 1,000 years later?
Right. All right, so then they're at the stone table, and the battle starts, and, you know, long story short, things aren't going well. And here's another interesting, is it a plot hole? I don't know. But the rules about, I think you're going to know what I'm talking about immediately. The rules about using Susan's horn as if they can only use it once and it has to be at their greatest need was not something that Lewis ever said. Father Christmas told Susan, and when you put this horn to your lips and blow it wherever you are, I think help of some kind will come to you. So he never does say the thing about the greatest need or anything. So I just wonder.
Yeah, it's Dr. Cornelius. Where he says, take it, King Caspian, but do not use it except at your greatest need. So it is set up there, but it's not really, you're right, it's not set up by Father Christmas. So,
well, you know, and it's not just that. It's also the fact that Cornelius theorizes that the help might not come to this exact place. It might come to, he thinks, either Lantern Waste, where the children first appeared, or at Cara Paravel. Of course, it turns out to be... Actually, you're sort of wrong. It's not exactly Cara Paravel. They kind of land a ways away from Cara Paravel. That's a bit weird as well.
He was blowing it and he let it off too quick. I mean, if he'd only, they were traveling to Cara Paravel, it dropped him in the wrong place.
Right. but Trumpkin, you know, they send him off to, even though I love his journey. I love it makes me really respect Trumpkin as a character. The fact that he doesn't believe in these stories and yet he's decided Caspian's his king and he's willing to go on this wild, what he thinks is just a wild goose chase.
Yeah, he's loyal. So one thing is that he may be cynical, but he's not self-serving.
Yeah.
And that's what, ultimately, that's what allows for there to be any hope for him.
Well, ultimately, he does the right thing. He may not believe the right thing, but he ultimately does the right thing, which is what really counts. And finally, and I don't know about you, but at this point I got pretty wrapped up in Caspian's story. I've practically forgotten that this is about the four children.
Yeah. I mean, you're so into it, it's almost a letdown when you come back to the four children.
It's the moment where Cornelius mentions Caer Paravel as the other possible place the help might come. And especially when they say that Trumpkin should go there, that's when I had my aha moment. I actually put the book down and went, ah, it all makes sense now. Trumpkin's going to be the dwarf, and he's going to go there, and he's going to find them, and that's where I put it all together. Is that what you did, or when do you think you had your aha moment?
I think it was when Cornelius mentioned Caer Paravel when I put it together, but I don't think I don't think I was ready to go back to the Pevensies. I think I was still kind of in the moment and wasn't really thinking about, oh, well, I guess this is now the time where we return to the Pevensies and we're going to continue with them.
Right, and I think it gives the story a lot of momentum. It's like, oh, yeah, and now the Pevensies have to go back and help them, and you finally see how all this is going to connect.
Yeah, you kind of see, like, oh, okay, I can see why this actually, like, why their coming actually matters. Narnia is not just suffering from a bunch of bad guys in control with a lot of weapons. They're suffering from the lack of something meaningful. You know, yeah, Aslan could have brought four commandos into Narnia, but what they needed was the four kings and queens.
And clearly that's what Trumpkin wanted, was something more like the four commandos. He says, you know, I suppose you are the four children out of the old story, said Trumpkin, and I'm very glad to meet you, of course, and it's all very interesting, no doubt, but no offense. And he's like, the king and Triple Hundred and Dr. Cornelius were expecting, well, if you see what I mean, help.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sort of, you need that kind of voice of reason to say, you know, you need someone to acknowledge that, because the audience can sometimes ask, wait a second.
Maybe. It's funny. See, I'm reading it, and I just don't think of that. Like, to me, it was always, what are you talking about, Trumpkin? He's King Peter, man. What are you talking about?
Well, yeah, because
I just
think
sort of caught up in that.
I think because we understand, you know, like, Peter isn't going to be, I mean, yeah, Peter comes back as, whatever, 15, 16, but he's really not. We understand he's really not living with just the experience of a 15, 16-year-old. He's living with the life experiences of a 35-year-old.
And Trumpkin, of course, doesn't understand that. And that's why the next few scenes are cool, when you have, obviously, the very memorable sword fight between Edmund and Trumpkin, partially because I love the description of that sword fight. And then the shooting match with Susan, and finally Lucy using her cordial on him. And Trumpkin figures out what I already knew. Duh. These aren't just kids. These are the four kings and queens. I told you, Trumpkin, but you weren't listening to me when I was shouting at the page.
Yeah.
And finally, now that we've got all that out of the way, now that we've finally connected, how is the Caspian and Pevensies? How are they connected? And now we have to convince Trumpkin that they are the real kings and queens. Okay, finally, we can get on with the story again, and the plot can get moving again.